You were just listening to the Sonata Three Lakes by my guest, Daniel Dorf. Danny, who are our performers? And tell us a little bit about this recording. This is actually from an upcoming release.
Yes, that was Patricia Sermon on flute and Kostas Chardas on piano. And this is on a recording of all American music, a mixture of mid-20th century with more recent flute and piano music. That will be out on the Centaur label, I believe, July or June, and definitely in time for the National Flute Association's annual convention, which it's a wonderful event that I go to every year that has, depending on the city and the year, between 2,500 and 4,500 flutists go to this. Wow. And Patricia Sermon will be performing this at the convention. There's an old Dorf 60th birthday concert.
Who's Dorf? No, I'm joking.
The guy who wrote Carmina Burana.
Yeah. Ha ha. I had a feeling you might pull
well,
that.
Well, I've been called that before, but yeah. Oh.
Okay. Well, anyway, I just want to let you know you are listening to Classical Discoveries on WPRB 103.3 FM or online at www.wprb.com. Today we are celebrating the 60th birthday, as you've heard, of American composer Daniel Dorff, and we are going now to more of his music. Thank you. You were just listening to Three Little Waltzes for Flute and Clarinet by my guest, Daniel Dorff, whose 60th birthday we are celebrating today on Classical Discoveries. The music, dating from 2010, was just performed by flutist Leonard Garrison and clarinetist Shannon Scott, and that was from an Albany Records compact disc. Well, so far, Danny, we have heard works featuring woodwinds, but let us not give the wrong impression. You have indeed composed many compositions featuring other instruments and ensembles. On that note, no pun intended.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I guess you know me. It was intended. I'm trying to kind of hide it, but... And I know my wife is probably giggling right now. Mm-hmm. But no pun intended. You see, I had to say it again. We go to your composition, Peaceful Journey, which is so different than many of your more, I guess you could say, brighter sounding works. The story behind this composition is indeed very moving. Why don't you share a little bit about that with us and tell us our performers?
Right. And, you know, just as an overview, as you know from my music and people are hearing this morning, that in the scheme of things, I think I fall more in the spirit of Poulenc than other contemporary.
I would agree.
There's an entertaining warmth more than a profundity is the point of view, and that I came at it as a performer creating repertoire, which is in contrast to the way that some composers are more about the pure creation for the sake of stretching the boundaries.
And,
you know, like the way that Wyeth is compared to Kandinsky.
Yes, right.
So, and not to be superficial, but that to me, it brightens a world that's full of darkness. You know, I never wrote a 9/11 piece because to me, music is sort of inherently a celebration, at least. And it isn't for everybody, obviously, but for me, that's what it feels like. So that I tend to be uplifting and hoping to give the world something to smile during or whatever.
And we indeed need that today.
So the piece we're about to hear, Peaceful Journey, in late 1987, I was watching TV and I saw on PBS a show about Soviet Jews who were immigrating to New York in the 1890s. And this show was, rather than only focusing on the promising future of what life in the New World was going to be like, it also talked about the ethnic warmth of the Lower East Side, what they were getting, but it also focused on what they were leaving behind, that these immigrants, with all their hope for the future, were leaving behind their extended family and all of their friends and their careers. I mean, this is an eternal story in every way, probably even more so in the last few years than it has been in our lifetime. But for me, this story was about my great-grandparents, because I don't think often about my ethnic background, but this was so poignant. It was talking exactly about my great-grandparents, who were Central and Eastern European Jews who came here in the 1890s to the Lower East Side. It was exactly what that was. And it really touched me. So a composer's response to something like this is often to set the feelings to music. And this time I did that rather than only looking at the fun side of it.
Of music.
And I began a bittersweet work for cello, thinking about what it was like to be at once going to something new and promising and leaving behind all that warmth, combining the sadness and the optimism. And it is, I believe, clear in the music that it goes back and forth between that kind of... I don't want to say ambivalence, but the two sides of it. So originally the piece was called Hebrew Elegy, as a lyric poetic kind of plaint. And with that cellistic flash, it was a little tone poem. So a few months later, I gave a copy of the piece with no program notes to a cellist friend of mine, suggesting that he might want the premiere. This was someone who I knew through Haddonfield Symphony. And unbeknownst to me, he had AIDS, and this was in the 80s when everything was new. We weren't used to that. Yeah. People were very quiet about it. But he thought that I knew, and he assumed that the piece he read the title as Hebrew Eulogy rather than Elegy, and he was very touched that I had written a eulogy for him when I had no idea
that he had AIDS.
And he changed his funeral directions to include the peace edit. And I was so touched. And I also thought about the parallel of dying a slow death, and the way that some people look to their death as, you know, or, and this is someone who is very religious. And so he looked towards death as a kind of immigration in that way. And the parallel to the more tangible immigration compared to a friend of mine who was having this experience, I felt I had to change the title to, and so Peaceful Journey to me, it sort of encompasses both or everything. So the performers on this recording are Jeffrey Lestrapes, who is a cellist who went through Curtis, and I knew him when he played in the Haddonfield Symphony. He performed this when he was teaching at Oklahoma State University in Stillwater. Now he's down at Texas Tech in Lubbock. And his pianist is Thomas Lanners. And the recording is just a live recital, private, that they said. It's a beautiful recording that they said we could broadcast.
Very good.
Almost no one has heard this.
Well.
But we're listening to classical discoveries on WPRB.
And this is obviously a very moving tribute. And we're going to hear this side of Daniel Dorff. This is his Peaceful Journey.
Thank you.
You were just listening to music by my guest, Daniel Dorf, and that was his Peaceful Journey for cello and piano. Danny, who are our performers?
We were listening to Jeffrey Lestrapes on cello and Thomas Lanner's piano in a live recital from December 2005 at Oklahoma State University in Stillwater.
That would definitely be a wonderful addition to the repertoire.
That is my hope, it's a very beautiful piece,
a very emotionally, a lot of deep feeling in it.
Yeah, and also because of the content of the history, both of the immigration and the AIDS memorial aspect to it, there are contexts.
Yes, definitely. Wow. Anyway, let's go now to a bit about your output. You have written, of course, a large variety of music, but are probably most well known for your compositions featuring winds, a few of which we've heard already.
True.
That is sure, and you can't do a Danny Dorf show without wind music. That is, I think, you could.
You could.
But anyway, the point is that your wind music is very popular. Why do you think that is?
Well, probably a combination of several reasons. One of them being that since I'm a woodwind player myself, many of my friends, the people who I sit next to in ensembles or know how to small talk with about our instruments, are clarinetists and flutists, and particularly flutists. Mm-hmm. Another big part of my life is that my, let's say, day job, for lack of a better term, is running the publication department at Theodore Presso Company for the last 35 years.
You've been there 35 years?
I've been full-time for 35 years.
I was
a proofreader before that. Oh. No, you know what? No, I'm wrong. 30 years.
Oh, you see?
Sorry. Well, it hasn't even felt like 20. But,
you're also...
And I do mean that because
ahead.
I love what I do there.
Yeah, yeah.
And Presser has become... a very, I guess I'd say, the primary publisher of flute music really in the whole world as far as all those companies which publish everything. We've become known for our flute catalog. And part of that is because of some of the people who have, like Lowell Lieberman's Flute Sonata, became standard repertoire. And we always go to the flute conventions and we have some great pedagogical books and other great repertoire.
Yeah.
And then it goes full circle because I'm always there and I've made friends with these people and gotten commissions. And but other woodwind music, I think in many cases, it's also because of my attitude of wanting to create woodwind repertoire rather than wanting to create music to stretch the boundaries of what is the meaning of music and use woodwinds
yes,
in it.
Yes, yes.
So I've been very fortunate, especially in the last few years, that a lot of wind players like putting my music on their recitals. This past semester, the number of performances of several of my pieces, including ones you've heard on today or will be hearing later, on senior recitals and master's recitals and so on, has just been surprisingly large.
And what's great about all this, going back to what I do here, is that you are a living composer.
I am.
But I mean, this is so exciting when you get involved with younger people and, he's writing classical music and he's alive.
It's funny is that I guess this is part of getting old as well as having a career develop over time is that now when I walk into a university to hear a performance or to coach a rehearsal, people are actually glad to see me instead of, oh, God, what's he doing here? Or who is that?
Yeah.
And it makes sense because, you know, I remember when I was college age, if somebody who was 60 or whatever, whose music I was playing came in, I try to remember what that felt like the other way around.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, also, you know, in terms of being a listener, and look, let's face it, you're a living composer writing music that is absolutely delightful, and it makes the world, as you said, a better place with its happiness and its kind of upbeat attitude in so many ways.
Well, it's certainly music. My intent, so thank you
I
for
mean,
saying
it really,
that.
And I mean, it does wonders for our musical community and environment, really, by a living composer. I mean, this is great.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it should be clear from most of my music that that's very much what I want to be in the world. You know,
yeah.
The stand-up comics do this. There are a lot of people who just make people feel better when they walk in the room.
That's right. That's right.
I don't always have that effect, but, you know, in the long run, that's
saying,
the
though.
Philosophy of what
I know what you're
music
saying.
Can do. Yeah.
Well, let's change the direction a bit about our in the direction of your output. Change the direction of us talking about that. Are there any works in particular which have been minimally performed, which you feel deserve to really get out there?
Well, the one we just heard.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I thought you would mention that.
That's a hard question to ask a composer because
because you want to say everything.
We would always say everything, yeah, right. Or almost everything, because there are some that do get played a bunch, and there are some that I wouldn't, you know, if all of my manuscripts fell overboard,
yeah.
Whose life would I save?
Yeah, right.
I mean, some of them are...
They're all your children, basically.
Yeah, and, you know, some of them are failures or just not as interesting or whatever, but most of them, I still feel proud of.
Well, if you want to go to and find out about all these works, you can go to Daniel Dorff's website. Daniel, what's the website address?
It's danieldorff.com, and that's with two F's, so it's danieldorff.com.
And there will also be a link to your website on the playlist for today's show on my website.
Right, or just type my name into Google.
Yeah, it'll be there.
I'm hard not to find. I love social media.
Yes. well, I've heard that rumor.
Yeah, or... friend me on Facebook
and you really surprised me when you told me something this morning when you got here. You left your phone in the car.
Oh no, I was joking.
Oh, you were.
no, I left my phone in the studio when I went to the men's room, and you said don't spend too long checking your email over there.
Yeah, what would we do? And you know, how did we get along years ago without all this? Or maybe better. I don't know.
It is a fascinating question because, you know, I remember in the presser office when our then president instituted email, and we were thinking, oh, God, now, you know, we got to check voicemail and we got to check the letters that come in. Now we have one more burden.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and obviously everybody's life was like that 15 or 20 years ago, and it goes full circle.
It does.
I mean, what has YouTube done to... radio,
enhanced, you know,
and the whole recording industry.
Oh, yeah,
because,
sure.
For instance, Sonata Three Lakes, which we heard about half an hour
ago,
there are two CDs coming out, and I couldn't be more excited about both of them. But Cindy Brose, who's doing the second one, she has a YouTube with over 10,000 views on it, and I'm thrilled about Albany and the formal recording, but it's a lot of record sales. Or illegal downloads, if the case may be, to balance out 10,000 views on a YouTube. And there are several other YouTubes also that have a lot.
And there's so much stuff on YouTube which never was released. Or if it was released from older contemporary repertoire, for example, or other periods, if it was released, it may be out of print.
Well, and, you know, there obviously there's a lot of good and there's a lot of problem because the easy access to anything you ever want to hear is wonderful. And I take advantage of that like everybody does all the time. Anything you ever want to hear, you can find there. But at the same time, if somebody were looking for an unfamiliar piece, like say somebody is learning a piece of mine or a piece of anybody's, well, with commercial records, there's still no guarantee that it's played at the right tempo or with the right pitches or whatever, but there's more... of a vetting process, more of an editing process than sort of a private photo album that gets completely equally mixed with the very good recordings of it.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, that's just part of the way things are, is that when we listen, we can usually tell which are the performances that are indicative, mm-hmm. or if they come from a composer's website,
then you know that that's good, you know, something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I want to change the direction just for a couple of minutes before we hear our next piece. You made an arrangement of Keith Emerson's piano concerto, and you arranged it for two pianos, four hands. And how did this arrangement come into being? And you knew Keith Emerson.
This was one of the most fun things I've ever done.
Yeah.
And the rock and roller teenager in me, you know, through my work, and I must have 20 friends who've won the Pulitzer Prize and the world's most wonderful composers of series concert music, which is what I do.
Yeah, sure.
But I, you know, sometime I was at a recording session of Steely Dan, and I was more starstruck than when I met Elliot Carter or Messiaen. You know, who's to say why? With Keith Emerson, it actually was through Presser that this happened. Way back when the Works Volume 1 LP came out. Was that mid-70s?
That's a long time ago.
I think mid-70s. Yeah. Keith, being British, asked a British sheet music publisher who should handle his piano concerto because he didn't know that world. And United Music over in London recommended that Presser be the distributor and rental agent for that piece. And I wasn't there yet. I was still in school at the time. But the solo part, which was copied in someone's hand, was available for sale separately on a print-on-demand sort of back-corner kind of basis through the company. And he owned it, so it wasn't Presser's. We just could do whatever he said. And over the years, I said, you know, this is a 20-minute piano concerto, just like anyone else's. And
sure,
it would be great if we could handle this the way that we would handle a Bartok concerto or a Brahms concerto and have a formal engraving of a two-piano version so people could learn it. And a number of times I wrote to the P.O. box or the financial person who the royalties were going to, but we couldn't find Keith. Then came the internet. And once I found a Keith Emerson fan club online, I wrote the same thing there. I said, does anybody know him? Within 15 minutes, his next-door neighbor, who was his number one roadie, said, we're on it. I'll have Keith call you. It's a wonderful idea. So next thing I know, is this Daniel? Hello, this is Keith.
Oh,
and
my
gosh. Someone's playing a trick on me because I don't get a phone call from – I mean, I grew up listening to Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Being someone who was into both classical and popular music, that, you know, the progressive music of ELP and Yes and Jethro Tull,
yeah.
This was really, for me, the real grist, and it still is. So to hear from Keith was like hearing from God. So we chatted and figured out what to do, and he happened to be coming to the Tower Theater a month later. For those of you listening from out of our area, that's a 2,000-seat theater in the Philadelphia suburbs that has a lot of groups. So we agreed to meet after the concert. And I went to my first ELP concert, which was incredible. Even when they were in their 50s, they could play like in the old days. And Keith said, no groupies backstage. I didn't realize there were mainly very tough people wearing leather and chains who go to ELP concerts. But he shut the door because his publisher was going to be there. And I had to sort of sneak out the back. But we talked, and I said, you know, you need somebody to do the two piano version of it. And also, you know, I was comparing the full score to the recording, and there's no crotales in bar 37, you know, and I started.
Sure, sure.
He said, you know this piece better than I do. You do the piano reduction. And I said, well, if you'd like me to, I would love to, and then show it to you. And so I did it, and Keith looked at it, made some revisions. In the meantime, we got Jeffrey Beagle involved because I knew of him as someone who loved Gershwin and Leroy Anderson. And was very proactive. So Jeff Beagle learned the piece like in one day. It was remarkable. And so he became part of this group, and he's performed it and recorded it as well. So I got to know Keith, and we talked about other projects. And needless to say, I was devastated a few months ago when we lost him.
Of course.
But, you know, to work with one of my heroes, I never got used to the phone call saying, hello, Daniel, this is Keith. How you doing, mate?
Wow.
So
did you almost, you must have almost fallen on the floor when you heard that. I mean, your whole, something had to happen.
Yeah.
To you. Mm-hmm. Wow, what a story. What a story. That's great. Well, let's move on now back to your music. Tell us a bit about your concerto for contrabassoon, which we're going to hear now.
I love this piece. And some people giggle or snicker, and I don't get that. And it's, you know, it's the whole point, is what a beautiful instrument it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ravel knew it. If you listen to Mother Goose, that really beautiful solo and his concerto for the left hand. But those are just little excerpts. So this is a whole piece in that kind of spirit. This came about, I was in a orchestra rehearsal playing clarinet or perhaps bass clarinet. And a friend of mine named Norman Spielberg, who's a bassoonist in the area who did a lot of contrabassoon playing, said, you know, I could play, this is back in the days when the chamber orchestra was called the Concerto Soloists Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. And Norman was their librarian and personnel manager, and he got to play a concerto every season. And he said, I could play a Vivaldi concerto every season for the rest of my life and never run through them, but I like doing unfamiliar things too. Could we commission you to write a contrabassoon concerto? And I hesitated because I thought, my first thought was who would play it. And he said, are you kidding? It's not like a novelty instrument. Every orchestra has a contrabassoonist who doesn't have repertoire. And there are some bassoonists who double contra because they feel like they just need it on the side. Yeah. But there are some extremely passionate contrabassoonists who they play bassoon because they have to. They love contra. And there's quite a lot of people like that, I've learned. So once he started talking to like that, and the fact that I was a bass clarinetist who understood and loved the saxophone and the low instruments, he said, you're the one to do it because you know that it's like the ugly duckling, that it's beautiful and people forget to look at it that way. So Concerto Soloist Budget said you can write for contrabassoon, string orchestra, and any other two players. And, you know, choose what the other two were. And I chose clarinet and horn because very specifically for orchestration, clarinet is so high and supple. Mm-hmm. That it makes the contrabassoon sound that much lower by
contrast.
You know, yeah, exactly. You know, when you look at the optical illusions with different shades of gray and black and white, orchestration can be like that. And I chose the horn because it tends not to play passage work. It tends to be very lyrical and broad in its most native kind of state, which makes the passage work of the contrabassoon sound that much more supple. Mm-hmm. So it worked out beautifully.
Good.
The piano reduction doesn't work because of all this, but I made a quartet reduction where the piano plays only the strings. So it's the clarinet playing its part, the horn playing its part, and the piano reduction playing the string part. And that quartet really works well for a chamber
piece.
Very
good.
So this piece is 12 minutes long. Okay. It's three movements that are connected without stop. The tempo is sort of slow to medium to fast, so it's in a way like a Rossini overture that picks up steam as it goes along. The recording that we're going to hear is the Haddonfield Symphony, now we know them as Symphony in C, conducted by Daniel Heggie, who was their music director when this was recorded in 1998. And the soloist is Roger Sorwin, who we heard at the beginning of the show with Inner Deep Funk. Roger is titled as the contrabassoonist of the Louisville Orchestra, but he's been sitting in as the contrabassoonist of the Colorado Symphony for several seasons.
Very good.
And also is known as a monster. He performed this at the Double Reed Convention, and all I ever heard was everybody saying that he was a rock star, a monster, and other terms that we can't do without the 8-second delay kicking.
Okay, let's go on. This is Daniel Dorff's concerto for contrabassoon.